Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Market Volatility Conference Call. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mike Evans, Vice President, National Sales Initiatives. Please go ahead, Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Kate, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Market Volatility Call number 11. It's hard to believe that we're deep into month three of self-isolation for many Canadians, and we know these are extremely challenging times, but it's also good to know that the efforts we're all making are making a difference. So our goal with these various calls and webcasts that we're running on a weekly basis are to help you stay connected. Now, we heard firsthand from you, advisors across the country, that you value timely information on market developments from your partners, and that's exactly what we want to provide. Each week, we've been committed to bringing you relevant commentary from both a macroeconomic and portfolio management perspective, highlighting recent developments and investment opportunities. So today we're joined by two senior members of Mackenzie's management team. First with us, someone who's certainly no stranger to these calls, Todd Mattina. Todd is a senior vice president and co-team lead of the multi-asset strategies team at Mackenzie. Todd is a member of our global investment committee and the chief economist for our organization. He has an impressive resume with time spent at CPPIB managing currencies, 10 years with the IMF working to stabilize developing nations around the world, and most recently, time spent with the Investment Management Corporation of Ontario. Now, he'll be providing a macroeconomic perspective of the pandemic, the global fiscal and monetary response to it, and give us an update on exactly where we are now. Now, also on this afternoon's call is Dan Cooper, Vice President, Investment Management, and Portfolio Manager on Mackenzie's Fixed Income team, specializing in high-yield bonds and loans. Dan has over 17 years of investment experience and currently manages well over $1.7 billion in high-yield assets across a number of high-yield portfolios, including the Mackenzie Corporate Bond Fund, North American Corporate Bond Fund, our Global Credit Opportunities Fund, MHYB, our Global High Yield ETF. Dan also contributes his high-yield expertise to core fixed income products like Mackenzie's Strategic Bond, or MKB ETF, and the Unconstrained Fixed Income Fund, or MUB ETF. Now, he's going to provide us an overview of the high-yield market, the various high-yield products that he runs, and the ways to access high-yield opportunities within core fixed income products. Now, a few details about today's call. Today's call is being recorded, and a playback will be made available to you along with a call summary after this call that will be sent to you by your sales team. Also, after the presentations, we will host a moderated Q&A to give you an opportunity to interact and dialogue with both Dan and Todd and get them to answer any questions that you have. Anything we don't get to on the call, please direct back to your Mackenzie sales team, and we'll do our best to get you a timely response. So, gentlemen, welcome back. I've had you both on this call and the webcast before, so thanks for joining me again. Certainly lots to talk about and cover today. I would guess the best place to begin would be to start on the macro side, Todd, with you and I, as we've traditionally done, but so much to discuss in relation to the world and the process of that slow progression to reopening economies and that careful balance that we've been talking about, balancing off the differences between the social and economic benefits and perils of opening up. So why don't I toss it over to you, and we can get a sense of where we are and how we're going to set up our conversation with Dan on high yield.
Oh, great. Thanks, Mike. And it's really a pleasure to join you and Dan for the call today. So picking up on what you were just saying, I'd like to focus a little bit on the global macro outlook, but particularly I'd like to focus my remarks on how that outlook is shaping our outlook for global stock markets, the Canadian dollar, and then I'd like to kind of touch on portfolio construction issues in today's highly uncertain environment. You know, Canadian and U.S. stock markets have rallied sharply, obviously, since the low point on March 23rd and are currently down somewhere between 7% and 11% on a year-to-date basis. Similarly, U.S. high-yield credit spreads have dropped by more than 4 percentage points since the March low point. The market rally, you know, is really seemingly at odds with the severe state of the global economy today, with millions of people having become unemployed in March and April alone. Our team's outlook for global markets is based on three themes that we believe are important for expected returns looking ahead. And that includes valuations, the expected macroeconomic outlook, and what we call investor sentiment. So first, on a long-term horizon, the global stock market's current valuation relative to long-term fundamentals looks to us to be broadly in line with historical averages or historical norms, despite the sharp recent gains we've seen since the low point on March 23rd. So let's dig into that valuation question a little more. So fair value for major stock markets are driven by both an expected gradual recovery in corporate earnings over the next couple of years and lower for longer interest rates. So let's consider first the expected change in corporate earnings. The consensus forecast is for a decline in corporate earnings for S&P 500 constituent companies by about 20% this year, before recovering by something similar in 2021, which implies basically a slightly higher expected earnings level at the end of 2021 as we saw at the end of last year. So this expected recovery in corporate earnings to the pre-pandemic level really reflects the view held by markets that the pandemic is ultimately a temporary public health crisis that will eventually be resolved by the end of 2021. And if we believe the consensus forecast for earnings that over 2 years we'll be back to the end of 2019 levels for corporate earnings, then being currently somewhere between 7 and 11% below where we started at the beginning of the year doesn't seem completely unreasonable. In addition, the expectation for lower for longer interest rates is providing additional support to equity fair values. And to see why, I think it's helpful to look at long-term government bonds. Now, the yield on a 30-year U.S. Treasury has dropped by about 100 basis points from about 2.4% on January 1st this year to about 1.4% today. And that's increasing the 30-year Treasury bonds market value by about 26%, so quite a substantial rally in long-term government bonds. But just like the long-term bonds, stock markets provide investors with a long-term stream of cash flows, dividends. And we should expect a higher fair value for equity markets as long as longer-term interest rates are expected to stay low. And in fact, small changes in interest rates over the long term can increase theoretical fair value for stock markets quite substantially. So given this expected gradual recovery in corporate earnings over 2 years and lower for longer interest rates, the rebound in stock markets can be understood as a reversion in valuation towards long-term intrinsic value. Now that said, we don't see U.S. or Canadian stock markets as being highly attractive or unattractive at current prices. And that's to say that stock markets don't look seriously misvalued. So far we've only focused on long-term fair value, but we also need to consider medium and short-term factors that help us forecast expected returns over the next, say, 6 months to 2 years. So we look at expected macroeconomic conditions over that horizon of, say, 6 months to 2 years, because we think that's an important part of the picture. After all, macro conditions is partly explains why interest rates are expected to be lower for longer. Now, the economic lockdowns have successfully flattened the infection curve and helped us avoid overwhelming the healthcare system with a surge in COVID-19 cases. However, the lockdowns also brought a sudden stop to a large part of the global economy, leading to perhaps the most severe economic contraction we've seen since the 1930s Great Depression, with 3 million unemployed workers in Canada just in March and April alone, and over 38 million Americans who have filed for jobless claims since the lockdown began. And businesses, of course, are also facing a short-term cash crunch that threatens increasingly to become a broader solvency kind of crisis the longer the slowdown lasts. Now, fortunately, very aggressive economic policies in many major economies have removed that tail risk of a broader financial crisis, and low interest rates have provided a further boost to stock markets, as we've just discussed. So key macro policies that have been important in this way include an enormous increase in government budget deficits, levels that we haven't really seen since the Second World War, to replace lost incomes during the lockdown, and then also central bank easing by slashing interest rates to about zero, along with enormous direct asset purchases, which have provided liquidity and backstop credit markets. So in this context, the strong recent gains we've seen in major stock markets may not reflect necessarily expectations of a sharp V-shaped recovery, as many people have suggested, but rather just a prolonged slump that keeps interest rates low, combined with aggressive macro policy supporting a slow and steady rebound in corporate earnings over the next 2 years. The final theme I touch on would be what we call investor sentiment. It's a third factor along with valuations and macro conditions that we believe drive expected returns. Now, persistently high market volatility and uncertainty about the evolution of the pandemic suggests to us that investor sentiment for risk assets will remain modest. Now, the gains we've seen in the overall market have also been narrow. Let's say if you look at the U.S. stock market, for example, many sectors continue to lag behind, including energy markets, which are still 35% down year to date, financials about 25% down year to date, and industrials about close to 20% down year to date. And that really contrasts with the strong gains we've seen in more growth-sensitive and quality sectors, including in information technology, where we see strong positive gains year to date. So we really do see quite a huge range across sectors. Now, overall, thinking about these three types of themes altogether, we see that valuations and investor sentiment are neither really attractive or unattractive, but macro conditions remain a clear negative indicator for the outlook for stock markets. So given these mixed and conflicting signals, we're keeping a neutral position at the moment in our long-term asset mix between equities and government fixed income until we see a stronger risk-reward opportunity to tilt one way or the other. Now, our advice at this stage is to stick to your long-term asset mix. Rebalancing regularly can be very helpful. Historically, this practice has helped investors recover quickly after a sell-off in financial markets. And if you do have a different view about the way the economy and markets will be unfolding over the next 6 months to 2 years, we recommend that these kinds of tactical tilts relative to your long-term asset mix are conservatively sized. And that's a way to recognize, well, that the risk in the markets at the moment is higher than normal, so that a given tilt carries more risk in your portfolio than in normal times. Now, switching gears, most Canadian resident investors also hold sizable U.S. dollar-denominated investments, whether in equities, corporate bonds, or other asset classes. So for this reason, the other key asset class that I'd like to focus on would be currencies, and in particular, the Canada-U.S. exchange rate. Because we all know that that's a key driver of a Canadian resident investor's total return. And also, as many of us all know well, Canada's a trading nation. The Canadian dollar tends to be a pro-cyclical, commodity-based currency that outperforms when the global economy is strong, world trade is rising, commodity prices are strong, and stock market sentiment is improving. And today, until just recently, we've had pretty much the opposite scenario. And that helps explain why the Canadian dollar fell from about 77 cents at the beginning of the year in early January to just below 69 cents at the most distressed point in March to now just a little bit above 72 cents today. So I'm asked often, is this the time to hedge more or less of your foreign currency exposure, given that many clients tend to have a heavy U.S. dollar equity and other asset class exposure in their portfolio? Our team is keeping our FX hedge positions unchanged at their long-term, or what we would call our strategic levels, based on the Looney's long-term valuation, expected macro conditions, and investor sentiment. Just like we look at stocks, we look at currencies in the same way based on these three themes. And starting with valuations, based on our long-term model, the Looney's fair value is about 82 to 84 cents to the U.S. dollar. And the loonie can stay undervalued in the low 70s for a long period. And if you look back in the past, periods of undervaluation or overvaluation in the Canadian dollar can last longer than a typical business cycle. So valuation isn't the best for short-term timing, but it does give you a sense of the direction over the long term. So thinking more about the shorter run, next 6 months to 2 years, we have to look at macro conditions and investor sentiment. And these factors continue to favor the U.S. dollar over the loonie based on our model. Now, why is that? Well, the uncertain global outlook continues to attract haven inflows of capital into U.S. dollar-denominated assets like treasuries. And importantly, non-resident debtors globally have issued a lot of U.S. dollar-denominated debt, currently totaling about $12 trillion. So it's an enormous amount of U.S. dollar debt out there, forcing many of these foreign borrowers outside the U.S. to start hoarding dollars in order to ensure they can repay their amortizing debts and cover upcoming debt service payments. The U.S. economic outlook is also relatively stronger compared to Canada's outlook over the next 6 months to 2 years. Canada, as you all know, faces really a triple threat today. We have the pandemic-related slowdown, which has hit the economy, at the same time as an oil supply glut has hit our oil sector, depressing crude oil prices compared to recent years. And on top of those macro shocks, Canadian private sector debt is very high, particularly household debt. So in contrast to that, the larger and more diversified U.S. economy carries lower household debt as a share of GDP, which is an important driver because, as you know, U.S. consumers drive about 70% of U.S. economic activity. So we expect the U.S. economy will be better positioned to rebound from the pandemic over the next 2 years. So let me then just turn quickly to some portfolio construction thoughts. You know, many people have asked us our views on portfolios in the current uncertain environment coming with the reopening process and the continuing pandemic-related uncertainty over markets. And stepping back, and how do we think about portfolio construction? Well, one important view is that asset prices, like stocks and bonds, depend on how inflation and economic growth turn out relative to investors' initial expectations. In the next 2 to 5 years, we can never know for sure if we're going to face higher or lower inflation, or if economic growth will turn out to be higher or lower than expected. And while many obviously possible economic scenarios could happen, you can really simplify the problem into thinking about the future state of the world in terms of four broad types of economic scenarios. And these are, will we have higher or lower economic growth and higher or lower inflation? And our idea is that investors should strive to build resilient portfolios or asset mixes across these different possible economic scenarios. Now, if you look at a typical investor's portfolio, equity risk tends to drive most of the total portfolio risk and expected return. If you look at the classic 60-40 benchmark portfolio, equity risk typically drives at least 95% of the total portfolio risk. But equity really outperforms in an environment, a scenario of higher than expected growth and lower than expected inflation. So most investors have positioned to be sensitive to a pro-growth, low-inflation scenario. But looking out at over the next couple of years, other macro scenarios are also possible, such as lower growth and higher inflation, sometimes called stagflation. And most investors' portfolios would typically underperform in that kind of scenario. There's actually been a lot of speculation about could we be facing a higher inflation scenario once the global economy is back on a firm recovery path following a pandemic-related slowdown? Perhaps once we have medical solutions that finally resolves the public healthcare crisis we're currently in. So inflation risk could stem from a manner of things, including unprecedented monetary and fiscal policy easing in most major economies, reshoring of foreign production into higher cost local economies, which could start to unwind global supply chains that have helped to keep prices low across the world, and an overhang of high government debt to pay for this economic lockdown, which could also invite future inflation. Now, it's important to say that extreme stagflation, like we saw in the 1970s with the oil crises, don't typically occur very often, but when they do occur, they can be painful to investors. So for those investors who are particularly inflation sensitive, they may wish to hold some inflation sensitive type of assets. But for other types of investors, those can be an expensive form of insurance over the long term because these types of scenarios don't happen very often. It's also important to recognize that in our current condition, it's actually deflationary risks that are probably the dominant risk at the moment, as we're in the middle of the most severe economic contraction since the 1930s Great Depression. So instead of high inflation risk, Another possible scenario that we need to be mindful of when building our portfolios is a protracted period of sluggish economic growth with high unemployment and deflationary pressures. And in this type of scenario, this would put pressure on equities due to lower earnings. And low inflation scenario, though, would be bullish for government bonds. And I'm often asked, what is the case for holding government bonds in your multi-asset portfolio? And it's exactly this type of scenario where you still want to have an allocation to government bonds. So in this context, you know, realizing that we can't forecast the full range of future possible scenarios with any high degree of conviction or certainty, we need to build diversification strategies to have resilient portfolios across these different scenarios. And one aspect that I feel is important to consider are what I would call alternative investment strategies. These are strategies offering low correlation to traditional equity and bonds, which can be especially valuable when you're facing uncertain future range of scenarios, like higher or lower inflation or growth. So in that way, you can have a driver in your portfolio that can add value in rising or falling markets. But the key point, the bottom line, is to find strategies with lower correlation to traditional drivers of risk and return, such as classic public equities and government bonds. So let me stop there, and I'll be happy to take questions at the end of the call, and I'll stop and hand it back to Mike and Dan. Thank you.
Great, Todd. Thank you. I've taken a page of notes on your comments, but I think the main point of helping advisors think about the structure they're putting in place for clients in relation to their portfolio construction process really involves diversity, that it isn't a black or white, all or nothing, up or down type solution. You really need a diverse range of potential outcomes encompassed in your overall portfolio construction techniques. And I think McKinsey is an organization that offers a diverse range of products and services that can fit those needs. No doubt we'll have, as we have in the past, lots of questions about the specifics that people are trying to forecast and build into their overall portfolios. But that leads nicely into our next speaker, Dan Cooper, who, as I mentioned at the outset, manages high yield. So high yield is an increasingly important component into portfolio construction for fixed income. Core plus mandates that we have in the books, the various high yield products that I mentioned Dan has a hand in, I think are playing a key role in this low interest rate environment to providing yield and opportunities for total return. So Dan, why don't I turn it over to you and you can run through the current scenario. Been an incredible marketplace for high yield 2020 and the crisis that evolved with COVID and the lockdown and so forth was particularly hard hitting in relation to high yield spreads and loans. So let's get your sense of where we are now, perhaps where we've come from, and more importantly, where we're going in that space.
Hey, Mike. Sure thing. Thanks for having me on the call. You're right. High yield has been very topical, and we're having a lot of conversations about the space, both internally and externally. You know, clients, other managers wanted to understand, you know, how we're using high yield across our mandates, whether it be the high yield accounts or more the core and core plus accounts, because we've just seen such a big sell off already that you know we saw earlier in this year. And you know, what kind of opportunities have that generated, given the fact that valuations are that much more attractive than they were coming into the year? Because if you go back to December 2019, valuations were relatively stretched. You weren't getting compensated much for the risks that we saw present there. You had about a spread of 350 basis points versus treasuries. Despite the fact that we're that much later in the cycle, you know, we're 11 to 12 years into the cycle since the last recession, you're in the midst of a trade war. You know, is it phase one? Is it phase two? Where does it stand? No one really knew or believed it. And, of course, the elections that are upcoming this November. So, you know, what we saw in the high-yield market for a lot of 2019 was valuation is tightening because there was that indiscriminate buyer, that foreign buyer that, has a domestic fixed income market with a negative yield attached to it. I think there was that 1.15 or 16 billion of negative yielding assets globally. So if you're a pension company or insurance company in Europe or in Japan, and you have a certain target that you have to make on your return, and your alternative is negative yielding assets, it's going to drive you to other markets. And we saw a lot of money flow into the high yield market from those types of investors. Now, what no one saw coming, of course, is that black swan event. When COVID hit the markets earlier this year, we saw what was an unprecedented stretch of 21 days in the high yield market where every day we were down, 1%, 2%, 3%, to the point that we hit the lows, I think it was middle of March, around March 23rd. And high yield got hit hard. It got hit with the 1-2 punch of both the drop in the risk market as well as the oil sell-off, because energy is a big component of the high yield market. I think it was around 14% at the time. So with that, high yield was down, just like the other risk markets, it was down about 20%, and spreads widened out from that 350 basis points where we started the year out to 1,100 basis points. And I think high yield was hit disproportionately hard because these are obviously companies with lower ratings, and they're obviously, more at risk of default, especially if we're going into a recessionary environment that no one was predicting at the time. So nothing was priced in for these companies that would have potentially elevated leverage. Companies that are in more cyclical or weaker performing sectors, or companies that just aren't diversified enough or don't have this large enough scale in order to have a higher rating. So, in the middle of March, it was really hard to tell where the bottom was for the high yield market. You had the shutdown of the economy, and everyone knew that you needed some sort of policy action to take place. But if you remember back to 2019, the Fed cut, I'd argue, prematurely three times when it didn't really need to. So, it used some of its capacity in 2019 that it could have otherwise used in 2020. You had the two emergency cuts, but then the market still, what's next? And by the middle of March, the Fed, the Treasury, really surprised the market with their asset purchase programs. For high yield, the big component of that program was their ability to now lend directly to companies by buying corporate bonds, particularly investment grade, but also fallen angels, and also buying ETFs, both on the high yield and investment grade side. So once the Fed stepped in, supported the market, you saw all risk markets rise, high yield to fame. And for high yield, in a relatively short period of time, we saw the market bounce back from its lows. At one point, it was down about 20%, down to about 13% off the lows. At this point, you have a negative 7% return for the year. But that's a very bifurcated return. If you look at performance by ratings or by rating quality, you'll see that the higher quality segment of the universe, which is a little bit more of our focus, is down, anywhere from flat to down, 5 or 10%. Whereas the lower quality portion of the index, or the companies that are more at risk of default in a recessionary environment, they're down closer to, on average, 20%. In some cases, a lot more than that. But with the Fed now having stepped in, what they've done is really created a floor and removed some of that tail risk that was in the high yield market. And they were able to do this without really even buying a single bond at the time. Just the announcement of it was enough to get the market functioning again, which was their goal. Their goal wasn't to inflate asset prices or create a bubble. They just wanted the credit markets to function. And them stepping in gave the confidence to investors to supply that liquidity. So you saw secondary markets bounce. You saw the primary markets reopen with new issues getting done, and the market for new issues had basically shut down. So it got the wheels turning again. And it didn't just get the wheels turning for strong companies that we saw issue, like Netflix. We saw Burger King issue, Charter Communication, all stronger, less cyclical companies. But we also saw the market open up for the COVID impacted companies. So Carnival Cruise Lines, they got their deal done. They are actually one of the first. Delta Airlines, Six Flags Theme Park. They came to the market. They had to be creative. They had to do some untraditional deals to get it done. The focus was on shorter dated bonds, shorter dated maturities, right? So 5-year rather than a 10-year. These deals were secured, whereas most of the high yield market is unsecured. And obviously the coupons had to be quite large, but mission accomplished. The Fed was able to create that environment where companies that needed liquidity were able to obtain that liquidity, and really just buys them time to get through the cycle to the other side of this downturn. But what it doesn't solve is solvency issues. So liquidity to get through the cycle, but not necessarily supporting companies that shouldn't survive. So basically companies that should file will, and we're already actually seeing that happen. We've seen the default rate tick up just in the matter of a couple of months. Default rate's gone from 2% to 4% already. A lot of that skewed towards energy companies and that were high-cost producers, retail stores, a lot of companies that were going to file anyways, but definitely accelerated that trend for others. So 2% to 4% already. We know that defaults are a lagging indicator, and it takes time for companies, liquidity to dry up or covenants to breach. You have negotiations with lender committees and whatnot. But we feel that over time, by the end of the year, you're probably going to get up to about a 10% default rate. And a lot of that is going to be skewed to those COVID-related companies and, the travel and leisure and cyclical space where the business models are broken. But, that might be pushed out even to next year, to 2021, because of that liquidity that's opened up. Now, many of these companies that are going to default and are getting into trouble were in cyclical areas, areas of the market that are very driven by economic growth. And, coming into this downturn, coming into 2020, we didn't really find valuations that compelling. So we're actually underweight a lot of those areas of the market. Just didn't feel like we're getting compensated for the risk that we were taking. So whether it be our high yield mandates or our core plus mandates, we're very underweight the cyclical sectors. Airlines, leisure, energy, these are sectors that have been hit hard by COVID and are down, 25% plus year to date. Our focus was more on the higher quality segments like healthcare, telecom, cable, packaging, more stable, less cyclical sectors where valuations were still attractive. And we didn't feel like we were taking undue risk. And on top of that, we also were pretty lucky because, we saw what was going on in China. And we had about a 2-week window where, cases are rising, China's being shut down, yet the markets weren't really reacting. So we used that as our opportunity to even scale back further some of the more cyclical names that we did hold, whether it be, theme park operators, companies related to the airline space, or something like movie theaters, which was in the past a very stable area of the market, but we saw that risk and pared back those types of exposures. But at this point, with the sell-off that we've seen in high yield, we're actually starting to see parts of the market that look more interesting. So we're actually constructive on the space in certain areas. Certain sectors, secured versus unsecured, higher quality versus lower quality. So I guess just high level, probably be helpful to just run through some of the reasons why we think high yield might make sense to look at now. So first off, this is an 08-09. Now, from an economic pain perspective, it's worse, but that's evident. You know, if you're looking at unemployment, PMI, you know, some of the GDP estimates we've seen. But for high yield, this isn't 08-09. And the market's actually in much better shape now than it was at that point in time. And that's partially because of that, you know, unprecedented and drastic policy action that the Fed took. You know, really getting ahead of the issue and supporting the liquidity. So we didn't have that Lehman-type moment. But it's also because, you know, the financial system, it was in much better shape as a starting point. You know, banks had much stronger balance sheets because of regulations. Banks didn't have a lot of bridge loans outstanding to companies that they were forced to sell into the market. They'd already been syndicating out a lot of that risk, a lot of those deals to investors. So this wasn't like 08-09. Another reason we like high yield is the mix of companies is actually much higher quality now than it was back during the last recession. So double Bs, which are the highest quality segment of high yield, now represent a record 55% of the market versus in 08-09, it was only about a third of the market. So the overall index quality is that much better. And if you even dig in a little bit deeper, you know, peel a layer back on that onion a little bit, you can see that the fundamentals coming into the downturn for these individual companies, they were actually much stronger also. Leverage levels, you know, they're around long-term averages, not high like it usually is going into the end of the cycle. And interest coverage, which is the amount of earnings that a company has in order to cover their interest payments, is actually quite high. That is high. It's record high. And that's because companies have been using this low-yield environment that we've been in over the last decade to refinance their debt at lower coupons and push out maturity. So we don't have that maturity wall that everyone talked about back in 08-09. So fundamentals are actually quite good. Where there was a bit of a disconnect, though, was on the valuation side. Coming into this year, you know, that 350 basis point spread didn't really compensate us enough for the risk that I talked about earlier. So now at this point, with spreads widening out, things are looking more interesting. You know, spreads widening from 350 to 1100 and now tightening back to 700, you're getting about twice as much compensation as you did before. And if you look at a measure like spread per turn of leverage, which for fixed income measures the amount of compensation you're getting for each unit of risk, it looks a lot more compelling now than it did before. Now, with that being said, we don't think it makes sense to just buy an index, because from this point in the cycle, there's going to be winners and losers, right? There's going to be the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we think it's important to have a strong team in place, like we have, with a credit focus, where we have 7 analysts that are sector specialists. You know, they know their sectors in and out. They know what the opportunities are. They know what the threats are to get ahead of. And we're able to make those relative value decisions, whether it be, you know, up and down the company's capital structure of where we want to be invested, secured, unsecured loans, you know, high yields, convertible debt, whatnot. And then also, you know, across the rating spectrum, between investment grade and high yield. So now as a team, we're doing a lot in the high yield space, across all of our mandates. You know, it's because we do see more compelling valuations and stronger risk adjusted return potential. But we also acknowledge that there's still quite a bit of risk. There's still quite a bit of uncertainty in this recovery. So what we're suggesting to clients and investors is that you want to look at more defensive ways to play it. And within our team, we have a number of core plus mandates. The one that I work closest on, most closely with Steve Locke on, our team lead, is the unconstrained fixed income fund or the unconstrained bond ETF strategy. And we view that as more of a core component of a fixed income portfolio. And, you know, just to go through some of the details of the portfolio, it's a tactical go-anywhere strategy that aims to achieve an above-average yield, but also limit the risk or downside with their objective of having a positive return through the market cycle. So what that means to us is that in good times, we want to be able to generate a high-yield type return, like we did back in 2016 when we had a strong high-yield performance that year. I think high-yield was up 17%. The unconstrained mandate was up to about 15%. And in more difficult times, or as we get later in the cycle, like we are today, we want to limit that downside to zero. And we're going to do that by using the flexibility that we have in the mandate to reposition the portfolio as the cycle changes. So you've seen us do that over the last few years, reposition the portfolio away from high yield to other areas of the market where we saw better risk-adjusted return potential. And we did that to the point that we've actually reduced our high yield exposure by about half and repositioned to other areas of the market that we saw better risk-adjusted return potential. So better returns relative to the risk or the downside, making sure that we're getting paid for those risks. So we're doing up in quality trades, you know, moving into triple Bs where we saw better value and spreads had spreads compressed too much between triple Bs and double Bs. We're also moving up in the capital structure to loans, which are secured, you know, first lien, top of the capital structure. And just overall, just shifting away from credit risk to duration risk and really de-risking the portfolio ahead of the downturn. So flexibility was a key part of the mandate. The other key part of the mandate that we like to talk about is the permanent hedge that we have in place against the high yield basket of securities, the high yield component of the strategy, which is the riskier area of the fixed income markets and the riskier area of the portfolio. Right now, I think the high yield weighting is close to 25% weighting, but our policy as a team is to have a permanent hedge in place to limit downside risk. So coming into this year, we had downside protection insurance in the form of HYG puts that we bought at cheap levels in order to protect the portfolio from downside if high yield traded off. And that strategy really paid off as that materialized. So so it's a very important part of the strategy, and it's on at all times, but we have the ability to scale up the protection or down. And coming into the year, the protection was actually quite strong. So just to wrap up, there are more attractive valuations in high yield today than there were at the start of the year. But, you know, we think there's still some risk for volatility. There's still some risk for downside. And we just feel like a more defensive, you know, conservative way to play it, the recovery in the markets, the recovery in high yield, the recovery in the economy, is this unconstrained mandate as a core component of your fixed income portfolios. It's structured as a higher yielding alternative in what is a very low yield environment, obviously, but with the flexibility to outperform in the different market conditions that we might face. And all in has that downside protection in place to limit that risk in this uncertain environment.
So, yeah, that's the perfect way to frame it. We really wanted to emphasize today, sort of moving away from the idea of a high yield trade into the inclusion of high yield as part of your overall asset allocation decision. And I think you framed it well. The best way to do that is through unconstrained fixed income or MUB. The team that Steve has established really gives him the capability to draw on the talents of the various components of fixed income and build them into that one product. And certainly high yield is a major component of exactly that. So thank you both, Todd and Dan, for doing a terrific job of giving us an overview of the overall economy from Todd's perspective and then the fixed income marketplace and where we've come from and where we are. No doubt we'll get some lively questions. So Kate, why don't we canvas the lines right now and see if we have any questions for Dan and Todd.
Certainly, thank you. We will now take questions from the telephone lines. If you have a question and you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before making your selection. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. If at any time you wish to cancel your question, please press the pound sign. Please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There will be a brief pause while the participants register for their questions. Thank you for your patience.
So, Dan, why don't I kick it off with a quick question? We'll try to make this a brief answer if we can. You talked about the utilization of loans. We know that unusually loans were particularly hard hit to a greater degree than high yield, which is unusual given their higher credit quality. Just speak to that a little bit and perhaps the normalization of the marketplace and how we've seen spreads for loans recover.
Sure. Yeah, high yield and you know what else I'll start off by saying, Mike, is that in times of stress, correlations go to one. And we saw that in 08, 09, and we saw it again this year. So high yield and loans were both down about 20% at its worst. And high yield and loans have also similarly performed since then. I think they're both down around 7% now year to date. High yield did benefit from having duration, whereas loans didn't. Obviously, with the move we've seen in yields, high yield would have been a big beneficiary of the 10-year yield dropping down to 60 basis points. Loans didn't have that extra kicker attached to it. So although it's first lien, secured, top of the cap structure, and should outperform, without that kicker, performance has been very similar. And just to add to that, there are a few headwinds that loans are facing that high yield isn't. Lower LIBOR levels, right? That means lower coupons for investors. The CLO market, that was a big buyer of loans, whether it be new issue or secondary. That has come off. It's not gone away, but the CLO market has shrunk. And just in general, the loan market has loan-only capital structure, so liquidity is more difficult. So we still like the loan asset class. I think we've done a good job in the space. Movin's still very active, you know, looking at primary deals and working around the space. But I'd say our preference might be tilting somewhat to high yield versus loans, but still both asset classes that make sense right now.
That's great. Thanks for your comments. Kate, do we have any questions on the line?
Yes, thank you. Once again, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad if you have a question. Our first question is from Robert Montemurro. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my question. My question is this. So far, it seems that the government, the Federal Reserve, all the banks, central banks have been the biggest friend to the equity market, maybe even to the bond market. But would you believe that in the coming months and maybe coming years, as this stimulus money will have to be repaid somehow, may actually become the biggest enemy? Maybe they are looking at new tax hikes on Wall Street transaction, taxes on corporations, maybe rolling back some of the tax cuts that were implemented a couple of years ago. What will be your take on this in the coming years?
Thanks, Robert. Great question. And we can direct that to both Dan and Todd. Who cares to take it on first? Todd, why don't we go to you? And then we'll let Dan have a comment.
Okay. Well, thanks for the question. I think you're raising a very important point here, which is there's really, in the short run, there's really no choice but for government policymakers and central banks to step in, stabilize markets. As Dan was saying, make sure the markets are functioning normally. But now, once we finally get to the point of having medical solutions for what is ultimately a healthcare crisis, and we're on a firm recovery path, we're going to face two big questions, which I think you're touching on, which is one, how do we pay for the lockdown? Government budget deficits are really ballooning to pay for, basically, to replace lost income and to backstop businesses. And central banks have slashed rates, purchased assets, which have ballooned their balance sheets. And the question is, over the coming years, that there'll have to be some unwinding of all that government support, if not only just to have some ammunition for the next crisis, whatever it may turn out to be. So different countries, that's going to look differently. In countries with high starting taxes, I think there will have to be more focus on reviewing spending when it comes to sort of reining in government budget deficits to something that looks like a more sustainable footing. So there I have a country like Canada in mind, where tax rates are already starting high, similarly in Europe. In the U.S., tax efforts a little bit lower, and they just went through a very large corporate tax cut. We've already heard Biden and some of the other Democrats talking about unwinding some of those corporate tax cuts, if depending on how the election goes later this year. So there's going to be some complicated negotiations, you know, in terms of how we deal with the consolidation on the government budget side to get back to a sustainable footing for public finances. The most important question for me, you know, I don't think there's any issue in terms of a sovereign confidence crisis because of the big jump in budget deficits and big increase in government debt ratios. You know, long-term interest rates remain low. We're going to revert to a long-term growth rate that will help very gradually bring debt ratios down as a share of GDP over the long term. The real issue for me is making sure that some of the huge stimulus that's gone through the system, again, when we're on that firm recovery path, is taken out so that we don't have an inflation problem. And that's, for me, the most important indicator to keep an eye on towards, let's call it the end of 2021, perhaps even sooner. And that dovetails with, you know, unwinding some of these global supply chains, which have also helped keep prices low. So there's a number of factors. I think you're absolutely right. Like what happens after the pandemic and how we unwind the support. I think it's going to have an important impact on markets.
Dan, anything to add on that front? A lot of folks are worried about inflation. Others concerned about deflation. Where do you stand?
Yeah, I relate a lot of this back to China. It's that mentality of, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And a lot of companies got a bit of a wake-up call last year around the trade war, really having to reconsider their supply chains and think about what the best way to operate the businesses are. Because although, you know, they moved operations to China to save money on wages and whatnot, you know, there was obviously a risk factor there. And then to get hit with it again this year, on the back of the COVID disaster, really, you know, you're going to see companies shift behavior. Companies are seriously reevaluating and spending a lot of time and will be spending a lot of money to change our supply chains, you know, moving away from China, to other jurisdictions, you know, other low cost jurisdictions. Maybe it's India or other places in Asia, or maybe it's Mexico. But I do think there's also going to be a lot of jobs that come home, and I think on the whole that's going to be inflationary. So near term, definitely a deflationary environment, but look ahead, you know, 18 months, a year, 2 years, you'll see more inflation coming into the markets.
Great point, Robert. Thank you for that question. Kate, who else do we have on the line?
Thank you. Once again, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad if you have a question. There are no further questions registered at this time. I'd like to turn the meeting back over to Mr. Mike Evans.
Great, Kate. Thank you very much. Since, guys, we are coming to the top of the hour, so timing I think, is good. Why don't I give each of you sort of a two-minute summary as to what's on your mind, what you're thinking about current opportunities in today's environment and a thought we want to leave advisors on the line with. Todd, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Thanks, Mike. And thanks again for everyone listening. It's great to have this chance to connect with everyone. As on the multi-asset strategy team, the team that I'm a part of, the kinds of things we're keeping an eye on, I guess, tactically over the next 6 months to 2 years are some of the things I mentioned. And I guess I would highlight, for example, inflation risk, which we just chatted about in the question. You know, are we going to start to see rising inflation and what are its implications? To me, this is one of the most important risk factors to keep an eye on. I wouldn't say it's our baseline view that we're going to start seeing more inflation, but it's certainly the preconditions are there, particularly if we have a rapid recovery with the economy reopening. And if we should happen to have medical solutions that get us on a recovery path, the ingredients are there. So that is something that we're going to be keeping a close eye on. The other key factor I would say is as we start to see the economy rebound, if it rebounds sharply, more strongly than expected, that could start changing some of our active views, especially in terms of where we stand in our long-term asset mix, equities versus government bonds, Canadian dollar, U.S. dollar exposure. So that, to me, is the other key thing to be keeping an eye on over the coming months is those leading economic indicators to see if they're starting to tick up faster than expected. I think that'll start to have an important impact on our active management.
And I think your wise counsel about revisiting your asset allocation mix, ensuring that it represents your long-term views, that you haven't let this market sort of distort you in one direction or the other, is wise. Dan, why don't we give you the sort of the last sure. word and sum things up?
All right, good stuff. As a team, we at Fixed Income Team, we all agree that we should expect quite a bit more volatility through the rest of the year. This is a very uncertain environment and really unprecedented times. We saw a big drop over the course of the 21 days that I mentioned. But we've also seen a pretty strong recovery in a very short period of time. You know, you have to wonder, is this a bit of a head fake? Is this a bear market rally? Where do we go from here? And I think it's going to take an extended period of time to play out. And, I don't think it's the time to jump in and take excessive risks. I think you want to add risk at a very measured pace and be very thoughtful about it. As a team, I mentioned we're very light the cyclical areas of the market. And with the sell-off, we've seen a lot of opportunities present themselves. But we're not going down in quality. We're not reaching for yield. We're very focused on maintaining, a conservative investment and defensiveness. But we still find ways to play the upside. Instead of buying unsecured bonds, we're more focused on buying secured debt in some of these cyclical sectors, including the airlines. We're also focused on buying higher quality risk within these cyclical sectors. These are companies that we have confidence that they're going to survive and even maybe thrive coming out of this. So, definitely just be considerate of the environment we're in and being a little more conservative.
I think that's a perfect spot to leave it. Then we've got Steve coming on the webcast on Thursday for those looking for a deeper dive on the fixed income suite of products. We can chat with him there. But Todd, Dan, thank you very much for your comments today. I think the theme of diversification, asset allocation, and a review of your mix makes a lot of sense. We recognize that advisors on the lines are fielding lots of questions from their investors, and we want to provide access to manager commentary and thought through calls like this one. We'd like you to join us on more of these calls. We've got a complete suite and record of all of the calls we've engaged in. This is investor call number, market volatility call number 11, but we've done more than 20 calls and webcasts in the last 3 months. If you go to the Mackenzie website And you can, under the COVID-19 landing page, you'll see a complete summary of manager commentaries, a lot of the presentations presented, and rebroadcasts of a lot of the calls. These are designed to be a resource to add structure and value to the conversations you're bringing to clients. We want to thank you for your partnership. Where our continued commitment to giving you access to information will continue into the future. I think one of the questions people often ask, what has changed and what will remain changed into the future? And I think it's the way and frequency of our communication with advisors that you see through calls like this one. Thanks again. We know these are extraordinary times. We wish you and your family well and a safe and healthy future. And until we join us again, thank you very much and be well.